Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Welcome back to Ring of Fire. My name is Sam Cedar. If you're just joining us, you can catch the first 2 hours of our show by becoming a member of our podcast. You'll get our full show, commercial-free, plus bonus content you won't find anywhere else. Just go online to rofpodcast.com to sign up. Joining us to help finish up the Ring of Fire news of the week, my good friend Cliff Schechter from Libertas LLC. So, Cliff, of course, we are just days away from the election. There's a lot of other things that are going on in the news to a certain extent that are all sort of, I don't know, touch on some of the major themes of this election a little bit sideways. And I have a feeling we're going to see a lot more of this type of stuff, regardless of whether or not Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, whichever one of them ends up winning. But particularly if Donald Trump ends up losing this election, hope springs eternal, that I think we're going to see, you know, an increase. And I think we already have seen, frankly, an increase in this type of stuff, not all like this this ambush by this obviously deranged guy in Iowa of two police officers. But this guy fits the profile of at least that which is, like, I guess, getting more, I don't know, oxygen in our society or more opportunity in our society.
Yeah, look, it's not to say, Sam, that this is the first time, you know, we've seen something like this. We've got, you know, a guy who was connected to the Don Young representative from Alaska, as well as the National Rifle Association, who had a plan to ambush a number of police officers named Schaefer Cox, a domestic terrorist who is now in prison for about 25 years. We had that case in Las Vegas, you may remember, from a year or two ago, where that couple who were at the Bundy Ranch walked up and ambushed police officers, shot them and murdered them. It's not to say this hasn't happened before, but all these sort of these right-wing cultural movements reinforce each other, and Donald Trump has brought them all together in a very open fashion, in the manner in which nobody has in recent years, in a long time, frankly, in this country. And, you know, a lot of different forces have made this acceptable. Donald Trump's not somebody who cares about social or societal norms. He's proven that again and again in his business dealings in the past and other ways. So not a shock that he'd be the one to lead the charge on this. But look, you know, they all deserve blame for this. It was after a Republican debate and a period of time when you had people like Carly Fiorina talking about babies being aborted after they were born and baby parts, that a guy shows up in, you know, at a Planned Parenthood in Colorado Springs and shoots people mumbling about baby parts. I mean, there are unhinged members of society. We've done everything we can to make it as easy for them as possible to get their hands on dangerous firearms. And then we have people out there who are lighting that match. And I mean, I don't know at what point it becomes inciting riot. I don't know. I mean, that's sort of the phrase, whereas Donald Trump has almost literally said, punch him in the face, or, you know, I mean, he's literally told his people to do violent things. You've got the Ku Klux Klan endorsing him. You have David Duke, longtime Klansman, standing up, who's got 5% of support now in polls. So he's able to join a debate for Louisiana governor and spent a lot of the night talking about, well, not all the Jews are bad, but most of them who run the media and the country are doing this and that and the other thing. I mean, they've opened this Pandora's box, and I think what it's also shown how vulnerable our democracy is in the years after World War II.
Let me disaggregate some of this because there's so much of this going on, and I do think it's all sort of basically on a spectrum. But let's try and stay, in one part of the spectrum, and then we'll move into the other. Because you brought up David Duke, who in this week, like you say, in a debate, seemed to have really not much hesitation talking about why he was referring to CNN Jews and, big governing international cabals. But, you know, earlier in the week, maybe it was the end of last week, Curt Schilling, the pitcher for the Diamondbacks and the Phillies and the Red Sox, who's now looking to maybe run for Senate in Massachusetts, got on CNN and basically said to Jake Tapper, "You're a Jew. Explain to me why Jews are voting for Democrats," which is just, it just shows, I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of the people listening to us didn't even hear about that. These are stories that
just
would
sort
have
of
been
openly identify people by their ethnic origin or that kind of thing, and not necessarily in a complimentary way, but a reminder that we're all different.
The point being, these are stories that would have been huge news a year or two ago, but we have moved into this area where, like you say, the norms have been blown out, not just in terms of that, but like you say, in terms of our democracy. I mean, we now have three Republican senators who are saying they will under no circumstances confirm a Supreme Court justice. We're one short, incidentally, folks, a Supreme Court justice nominated by Hillary Clinton. We have one Republican senator, and let's name these, McCain, Burr, and the guy that McCain said was a wacko bird, Ted Cruz, are the ones who are basically saying, we're not going to fulfill our obligation to put a Supreme Court justice on the court.
Right.
And then you got Ron Johnson, who is channeling his inner Trump out in Wisconsin, saying that he's already talking about impeachment of a president who hasn't even been elected yet. I mean,
right. He's not the only
not
one,
attacking,
by the way, too.
They're
John
not attacking.
Cornyn came out and said, well, maybe we shouldn't impeach, but certainly we can build up more evidence. I mean, and a number of House members have also brought up the same thing.
They're
attacking.
This is not politics. This is attacking institutions of our system.
Yeah, I mean, it just shows. I mean, the way to deal with these types of characters, frankly, that have dragged our political system to the right, into the gutter, has been to expose them for who they are. When Joseph McCarthy stood up and behaved the way he did, he was exposed for who he was. His own party denounced him. But we're in a different place now. That's historical memory is all gone and of authoritarian movements in the mid 20th century. And we've allowed ourselves to get to a point where, we can tell the story a lot about these forces, but the story can't be told without the unbelievably miserable job that the political media has done, to a point of where I didn't think they could sink as low as they've sunk this election. But they have spent studies just coming out, they've spent so much more time on Hillary Clinton's emails than they have on her policy proposals. A grand total of 32 minutes, by the way, in network news on policy proposals. So nobody's heard about what she may want to do for them. They've just heard about these emails. I mean, as if that is something important to our democracy, and the number of things wrong with Donald Trump have received at most, equal time to that. I mean, it's utterly incredible. It's like you're watching the demise of the Roman Empire in front of you. And
yeah, I mean,
I don't mean to be hyperbolic, but that's the way watching this spectacle, of where nobody seems to want to step out of their preassigned role and say, this is insane. This is not the way a democracy runs. It's not the way it's supposed to. This is, we're in a situation now where we're giving open and free pass to white supremacists, who are now saying, by the way, they're going to come out and try to intimidate voters on Election Day. We've got voter suppression of African Americans. We've got admitted emails that have come out in places like North Carolina. I mean, we're off the rails right now. And I don't know.
No,
I mean, even Hillary, go ahead.
Well, all right, we're going to take a break here. And I just wanted to add, though, the Department of Justice this week basically singled out North Carolina. I've talked to Greg Palast earlier in this program about the Republican suppression of votes and disenfranchisement. The DOJ has stepped in and singled out a couple of counties in North Carolina, which have disenfranchised black people by their caging technique, which is illegal. It is illegal, and they're doing it. And all right, we got to take a break. When we come back, let's talk more about this, because there is a real, I do have a sense, particularly with the Comey thing this week, that there is a, our whole system in many respects is under assault. We got to take a quick break. Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. We're talking to the great Cliff Schecter. We'll be right back. Counting all different ideas drifting away. Past and present, that don't matter, not the future, sort it out. Watch your mind. Back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar, here with best-selling author Cliff Schecter, finishing up our Ring of Fire News of the Week segment. Stories you can find on our website, ringoffireradio.com. So, Cliff, when we broke, we were talking about the sort of the full spectrum array of assaults on norms, institutions, people. That is happening, and that has happened over the course of this presidential campaign. Everything from the way that the press has handled this campaign to Republican lawmakers talking about impeachment of a president who hasn't even been elected yet, talking about nullification and engaging in nullification of the president's right to appoint a member to the Supreme Court. We have a Republican candidate who's saying there's no way that if the Democrat gets elected that it'll be legit. We have the head of the FBI breaking every single Department of Justice and FBI protocol I've talked to U.S. attorneys who have told me that even if there were charges, they wouldn't bring it up this close to an election. They nobody would approve of that. The idea of just talking about that there is, some type of a potential evidence. I mean, all of these things are assaults on our norms and our institutions. And I think there's obviously been problems with these things. It's almost as if, you know, it's a stress test to have someone like Donald Trump run. And we're starting to realize, like, there's a lot of problems in the system.
Well, yeah. And I think that goes beyond there are a lot of problems. It goes beyond, it gets to the point of they're existential. I think that everything I'm seeing tells me that Hillary Clinton right now is in a solid position and very likely to win this election. But, I mean, does anybody have any faith now going forward? If you had any faith in our system that it could stop the rise of an autocrat in the mold of a mid-20th century fascist, I have no faith in that anymore. The alarm bells that were supposed to go off didn't go off. And it's sort of like after we went through all this, after the first time when the media spent 2 to 3 weeks obsessing on non-stories about emails, when Donald Trump was being endorsed by white supremacists and was retweeting them and stuff, these things would get a day of attention when they were spending days and days, and not just, you know, conservative media and whatever. We're talking about the New York Times, who was editorialized so strongly against him, but their news division, for some reason, seems to not understand what democracy is about. I would say much of the Washington Post, with a few terrific exceptions there. CNN has been an absolute joke, and I could go on and on. I mean, it's sort of like every sort of, you know, anything that you rely on at all, that they would get it eventually, because it was proven again by this Comey situation. That easily could have been something that they all could have mentioned in one article the next day. Instead, they all chose to go in overdrive mode again. This is after the sex tapes of this guy, or I shouldn't say the assault tapes of this guy bragging about assaulting women. Numerous women, a dozen women have come out. The guy's on trial, is going to be on trial for rape of a 13-year-old. He's going to be on trial with Trump University for defrauding people out of their life savings. These are trials coming up in November. I promise you, many more people know about the emails than know about either of those things. I mean,
Incredible. let me just say this about the there is a lawsuit that the first hearing is going to be in December by a woman who claims that Donald Trump raped her when she was 13. And apparently, according to the affidavits filed, there are corroborating witnesses. But now, with that said, look, it is the woman was scheduled to have a press conference this week. She didn't show. There's a lot of questions behind that suit that I think are dubious. And I'll tell you something, and the media has not reported on that, largely speaking, because of the dubious questions. People have tried to interview this woman, and she won't make herself available for interviews. When they filed in California, they had used a foreclosed house. It's not clear what the deal is with this case. But with that said, I think the reason why you've seen hesitation from the media to talk about this story, because there's nothing to corroborate it yet. There's none of the normal things that you need to report this as a legit story, right? Because anybody could file a lawsuit theoretically, I don't know that anybody would want to do this, frankly, if they had to put themselves out in front of this, which is why I think there's been some skepticism.
There was no evidence of anything, any actual impropriety with the Clinton Foundation. How much time did they spend on that? I agree.
This is my point, is that I think the press was right to have some hesitancy in regard to this lawsuit. But when you think about someone like Comey, who has a greater responsibility because of protecting the integrity of the Department of Justice and the FBI, to come out with stuff that is really, there's nothing there. And then you're right, the press has been all over this other stuff, this complete innuendo. It has been pretty stunning.
That's the thing, is that there's other stuff that isn't innuendo, okay? The coverage that even these women have come out and received, which was substantial for about two or 3 weeks, has not reached the email coverage. Trump University has not reached that. His employing of undocumented workers and then not paying them has not reached that. His stiffing contractors, waitresses, all sorts of people has not reached that. His illegal foundation that never filed has not. I mean, we could go on and on about the number of things this guy has done in his business life, his personal life, and none of them have come close to that coverage. Well, and you just sit here and you shake your head. What is wrong with you?
Well, Cliff, hopefully after next week, we'll have... At the very least, his candidacy will be in the rearview mirror. I doubt that Donald Trump will be.
And I hope believe it's going to happen, Sam. But we'll have all new problems, and we'll have to trust this press to tell people what's going on once Hillary Clinton is hopefully president.
Don't get overconfident with this. People should get out there, make phone calls, do what they need to do.
Of course,
Cliff,
get out.
As always, a pleasure.
Thank you.
Cliff Schechter is the best-selling author of The Real McCain and the president of Libertas LLC. He's also the founder of Majority Ohio and Majority Ohio Action Fund, and a columnist for the Daily Beast. Coming up, we'll explore what Donald Trump's Supreme Court may look like. I'm Sam Seder. We'll be right back on Ring of Fire Radio. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Seder. What would a Donald Trump-appointed Supreme Court look like? According to our next guest, it would be devastating to workers across the country. Joining me now to discuss her piece on the popular blog Informed Comment, the venerable professor of law at the University of Baltimore, Michelle Gilman. So, Michelle, we, of course, have heard quite a bit, maybe not as much as we should, about the fact that the Republicans in the Senate are now saying that not only did they have to wait for some reason to hold confirmation hearings for President Obama's pick to the Supreme Court, saying that apparently a president in his final year of his term doesn't have the right to appoint anyone, but now we're starting to hear arguments from Republican senators that you don't necessarily need a full complement of 9 Supreme Court justices tabling that for a moment, the flip side of this argument is, in the event that Donald Trump becomes the president, a Republican Senate is sure to hold confirmation hearings.
Right. It's pretty ironic that, you know, this party that's associated itself with constitutional originalism is now ready to read the Constitution only for their own purposes.
Yeah, it's shocking. Let's address that before we get into, you know, specifically what areas would a Trump presidency impact in terms of a fifth justice, but then even possibly, you know, a sixth justice. Before we get there, is there any precedent for a Supreme Court with less than nine people? I mean, certainly FDR famously suggested that he would expand the size of the Supreme Court and do some court packing. But is there a precedent for a court smaller than nine justices?
Yeah, not to my knowledge, although I'm not a constitutional scholar, so I can't say that definitively, but surely it's nothing we have seen in recent times.
Okay, and so, all right, let's go into the piece that that you wrote that at the very least was on Informed Comment. I mean, give us a sense of what things, I guess, are the obvious things that Donald Trump would impact if he replaced Antonin Scalia, and what things are less obvious.
Sure. Well, he has promised that he would appoint only the most conservative justices in the mold of Justice Scalia. And right now we have a court with four reliably progressive votes and four more reliably conservative votes. And so this one seat makes a big difference. We just came through a term where we saw a lot of four decisions, and in the absence of Justice Scalia, now we're getting four decisions. And this isn't true on every issue that the Supreme Court hears. They hear many issues that we would consider sort of nonpartisan, but on a lot of hot button issues, this one appointment could very much tip the balance. And a lot of those issues were mentioned by Trump and Hillary Clinton at the third debate, such as abortion rights, Second Amendment, overturning Citizens United, stakes for marriage equality. And what I was trying to focus on in the piece that I wrote this week is there's another really big issue that no one's talking about that impacts, you know, everyone in the workplace on a day-to-day basis, and that's what the Supreme Court means for workers.
Yeah, and I want to get into that. I mean, we've even seen this. I mean, there's two things I want to address first. I mean, one is more broad than the other. But we have seen the impact for workers just in Antonin Scalia dying, to be a little bit crass about it.
Yeah.
I mean, never mind the fact that, we don't have a court that's active. But when you look at the Friedrichs case, which involved public sector unions being able to charge an agency fee for the negotiations they're doing on behalf of everybody in a shop mm-hmm. that is working, whether they're union members or not. Were it not for Antonin Scalia having passed away, Friedrichs would have basically gotten rid of that agency fee and could very well have, I mean, it certainly would have meant massive changes for public sector unions, but could mean the slow degradation of those unions.
Absolutely.
And so just his absence itself had an impact.
Yeah, and so it's also important to realize that the conservative justices were aggressively looking for a case such as Friedrichs so that they could overturn agency fees. And so it's really just an unlucky fluke for the conservative justices that it was not overturned. But believe me, if a conservative justice gets appointed in the future, they will pull the next case possible to do what they couldn't accomplish this last term.
Yeah, and that's one of the other things I wanted to ask you about. I mean, I want to get into some of the other specific cases in a minute or two here, but will you just sort of like broadly speak to the idea that these cases, I mean, the Supreme Court, that dynamic of the Supreme Court and particularly the conservative justices, and I'm sure the more liberal justices, and these are in artful terms because, everything's sort of relative. But they look for cases, but they don't actually literally look for cases. It is more of a push. They look for cases that are coming to them. Will you discuss that dynamic and also the dynamic that involves legal groups, whether they are conservative or liberal, starting to pursue cases downstream, or I should say, I guess, upstream of the Supreme Court, with the hopes that this will be a case in which the Supreme Court can change law, right? I mean, we saw this with things like the Voting Rights Act. We have the same organization that found a plaintiff to bring the Shelby case, which ended up gutting the preclearance provision of the Voting Rights Act. There are numerous other examples of this. I imagine that takes a while, and that the conservatives have already put into the bloodstream of the court system cases that they hope will create new law that is more inclined to favor, I guess, conservative ideology.
Absolutely. It's part of a very strategic political plan. And conversely, if you're a progressive lawyer, there are cases you're working to make sure don't get to the Supreme Court, right? So it operates in both directions because of fear what might happen when it gets there.
All right. Well, so tell us, I mean, how that works a little bit more, because I don't know that people are sort of aware of that dynamic.
Well, at least on the progressive side, some of it has to do with, is this the right time to take up certain cases, or is it better to let certain cases end at the appellate level or not to bring them in the litigation process at all? So it affects both sides, not just the conservatives, but the conservatives have been very, very good at strategizing around these issues, and knowing that they had sympathetic justices who would pick their cases, it's important to recognize that only a small proportion of cases that where parties are seeking review by the Supreme Court get selected. I mean, the process is called granting cert, and cert is only granted on a small percentage of cases that seek court review. Traditionally, the Supreme Court was seen as stepping in, if there was a circuit split, so courts around the country couldn't decide on an issue or a particularly vague statute that needed to be interpreted. But now it seems like there are other guiding criteria that are pushing justices to pull certain cases.
And if I'm one of those lawyers who's strategizing, am I trying to assess, based upon rulings by the Supreme Court justices, like they would be open to this, or they're in this dissent are signaling they would be open to that? I mean, how does that work?
Yeah, absolutely. It's not too hard to read the tea leaves. I mean, you could read, for instance, cases involving unions over the past couple years and see that there's a very strong inclination on the part of the conservative jurists to overturn settled precedent about agency fees. And so if you're part of this, right to work movement, for them, the time was right to get one of these cases, to get it queued up before the justices as soon as possible. And in that case, the strategy didn't work. But again, if there's a Trump justice in place in the future, they'll queue up the next case.
All right. Well, let's take a break and talk about some of those cases, and particularly an assault on class action. We got to take a quick break. Sam Seder, Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be back in just a moment.
Return to the Mac. Get up, what it is, what it does, what it is, what it isn't. Looking for a better way to get up out of bed instead of getting on the internet and checking a new hit. Me get up. First shot, come strut walking. A little bit of humble, a little bit of cautious. Somewhere between like Rocky and Cosby's for the game. Nope, y'all can't copy yet. Glad moonwalking. And this here is our party. My posse's been on Broadway, and we did it all way. Chrome music. I shed my skin and put my bones into everything I
We'll be right back.
back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Right now I'm talking with Michelle Gilman about her piece, Why a Trump-Appointed Supreme Court Would Mean Workers Are Screwed, which you can read now at wancole.com. So, Michelle, before we broke, you were basically outlining to us the broader processes of how cases get to the Supreme Court, the strategies that and just the idea that these are strategized. It's not random. The justices have an agenda. They see areas of the law that they think they can impact or want to change. And the advocates on both the liberal and the conservative side try and start cases and find plaintiffs that they think will go up the food chain, as it were, and might appeal, might be the kind of case that a Supreme Court justice is interested in looking at, and one that could actually change some law. And yeah, you were specifically, I mean, we talk a lot about the idea of like, certainly Donald Trump is claiming he would appoint somebody who would overturn Roe v. Wade. We know issues of Second Amendment have come up, but there are other issues. We were talking about labor law, essentially, and issues, courts that affect both consumers and workers. Tell us about the idea of class action. How would Donald Trump, I mean, why, and I think our audience is fairly savvy about this, probably more so than most, because Mike Papantonio, of course, does a lot of these type of cases. But why are class action suits important to workers and to consumers?
Sure. Well, they're a very valuable tool. There are two sort of primary reasons. One is a lot of these claims on their own are too small to justify the expense of bringing to court. So they might have a lot of value to the individual worker or the individual consumer, but the money at stake is not enough to hire a lawyer, to pay for a lawyer, or for a lawyer to see it worth their time. So by aggregating relatively small claims, important issues get litigated. At the same time, it's a lot more efficient for a court to hear a lot of smaller claims at one time rather than independently, separately. So it definitely promotes judicial economy to have class actions.
All right, and so what's the threat to class action that a Trump presidency could present?
Well, they're definitely, Justice Scalia was very skeptical of class actions and was part of a lot of rulings that limited their efficacy, and it's likely that another justice in that mold will use whatever tools are available to further limit class actions as an option for consumers and workers.
Tell us about Walmart versus Dukes so that people get an idea of why this is founded more in an ideological perspective than one that is legal. Or
yeah,
is that even accurate to say?
No, I think it's accurate, although, you know, the justices don't see themselves in partisan terms. But it was a 5-4 decision. Justice Scalia wrote it. So, again, you can see the difference that just, you know, one justice can make. And in that decision, past and present female workers of Walmart sued Walmart for paying and promoting them less than their male counterparts. It was a very large class action of over 1 million workers. And Justice Scalia said that the class action tool could not be used in that case. It's somewhat complicated, but the gist is that Walmart was just too big to sue. He said you can't find among so many people a common basis that explains why women were making less money. Okay, and he just ridiculed the idea that such a big company like Walmart would engage in a strategy of company-wide discrimination. In dissent, Ruth Ginsburg wrote the dissent. She explained quite clearly, to the contrary, that discrimination is actually most likely to flourish in the type of discretionary systems that Walmart uses. And the words we've heard a lot lately about implicit bias were part of what she was trying to explain. You know, she was trying to explain that it's not that Walmart supervisors are evil, okay, but that through the process of implicit bias and subconscious assumptions about women as workers, women were getting the short end of the stick. And when Justice Scalia was looking at employment law, he's really only seeing it as a tool to go after bad apples. And he just doesn't believe that such a big company could have so many bad apples. So one way to think about it is in a lot of these large employment cases, the dissenters who are more progressive are looking at the world from a bottom-up worker perspective, and the majority conservative justices are looking at it from a top-down employer perspective. They're just coming at these issues from just very different places.
I mean, one is, and that is, I guess, fundamentally ideological, all right? I mean, the perspective of the idea that there could be something systemic that is taking place. I mean, because, you know, I mean, it seems to sort of beg the answer a little bit when you say this thing is so big. I mean, it's just a coincidence that all these women would have less pay. There's no commonality. But of course, you've already mentioned what the commonality is, and that's the basis of the suit, that it's because they're women. And so he's looking for a perpetrator, a specific perpetrator, as opposed to the outcomes of a process.
Right. And it's a very old-fashioned view to see employment discrimination as just resulting from, like, evildoers.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that much of employment discrimination in the workplace today comes from implicit bias, subconscious processes, not where employers are intending to harm minority or female workers, but where just assumptions about those workers become part of the decision-making process. And one of the, you know, problems with Walmart was too big to sue, but one result, according to Scalia, but one sad result is that the decision gives the stamp of approval on subjective employment practices. And those are exactly the areas where discrimination is more likely to flourish. But once you give the stamp of approval to Walmart to engage in these kind of practices, well, then there's every economic and legal incentive for every other company to act like Walmart.
Right. I mean, we're talking about one of, if not, I think, the biggest employer in the country. I mean, so if it's a standard that the biggest employer in the country would follow, then why wouldn't everyone else? Now, of course, Scalia is now gone, and things may change fairly dramatically on the Supreme Court in the event that Hillary Clinton becomes the president of the United States. But it would also be fairly dramatic in terms of Trump, because, like we say, a lot of those cases are in the hopper already, as people did not necessarily anticipate that Antonin Scalia would leave us so quickly. Well, Michelle, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Pleasure speaking with you.
Michelle Gelman is a Venable Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore. That's it for this week's Ring of Fire. Don't forget, you can go to rofpodcast.com and sign up for our free one-hour podcast. And if you want the full show, commercial-free, become a member and support the show. You'll get full access to Ring of Fire content, and you'll help support the program. On behalf of Mike Papantonio, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., I'm Sam Cedar. We'll see you next week. Shut your-